What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of American Theses and our continuing season about health and wellness. This could be our season finale, but if we are inspired enough by community response, maybe we'll end it with a community episode. We don't know yet.
It could happen. I have no doubt that the community will fail us, but if you guys are actually useful, then maybe we'll do something. We'll fail you. One of the two is probably going to happen.
Our last interview, our last guest of this mini season is going to tell us, and we're going to focus on meditation, mindfulness meditation. And I'm really excited about this. This has been a practice for both of us.
Yeah, you've been very disciplined about it in a way that impresses me. Since when did you start?
My first class I ever took was with our guest, John Aaron. I took it in 2011 because my therapist recommended it for me. I was in a relationship, wasn't great, and she thought it would be of service, so I checked it out. I couldn't start a daily practice then. The next year I came back to another class with John again, couldn't start, just for some reason it wasn't the right time then. And then I went to LA and I started my daily practice then. It's been about 3.5 years now.
I didn't know you retook the class. I think that would have actually helped me, because I took the class. I had to skip the last session, which was, I think she said specifically, I'm going to teach you guys about some cures for insomnia, and you know I have trouble sleeping.
Right.
Super hyped, and then I had to travel for work, and I missed it. And then I was like, I don't know, should I just retake a class? They don't offer them all the time. And then I just didn't, and I tried to do a daily practice. I was motivated for like 2 months, then lost it. But then this year, I tried to be kind to myself and build in some days where I wouldn't be able to. So my New Year's resolution has been to meditate 300 days. Some days, I do like a sleep meditation, which is like kind of cheating, you know what I mean? I don't sit there and do it in the way that I would prefer to do it, which is the full whatever, but I got Headspace, it's been helping, and I've been on track so far.
But it's interesting though, because one of the things that was the greatest for me with this practice was there was such a focus on compassion built into the kind of practice. I mean, simply sitting on the chair rather than sitting on the floor cross-legged and like with your back straight for 15 minutes, which frankly I couldn't do physically.
Can you now?
Now I can. I usually, if I'm meditating, put something on the back so that I'm not like focusing on it, so that I can focus on
the
breath. That's impressive. But there was like such an accessibility to this that I found that was really joyous. I'm curious for you.
I think I thought it would help with my temper.
Okay.
And I'm not, I think that and therapy has helped. In what percentage, I don't know what's what. But they talk about...
So Indian, man, talking about percentages.
Yeah, true. Very quantitative. But one thing they talk about, and I said I downloaded Headspace this year, so it's nice for me to have someone telling me what to do every time.
Right.
But he talks about like responding instead of reacting.
Yes.
And that's something I think I'm getting better at, and I would like to continue working on. And to be honest, I noticed with so many people around me, it's so much reaction, especially in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's reacting to everything all the time. My cousin's a psychiatrist. He said something about New York where it's like, New York is a city where any small thing that somebody does to you that anywhere else in America or the world, you would be like, eh, don't worry about it. New York is like, no, not only will I worry about it, I'm going to tell you to your face exactly why this bothers me and you need to know it. And it's like, that's just not healthy.
But that respond reactive thing has been really huge for me because I was very reactive. And I think I've gotten a lot better at that. And meditation has been a huge part for it. I mean, it's allowed me, when we were talking to Naveen in our last episode, he was talking about mentalizing. Meditation has been the big thing that's allowed me to do that, where now I have the space to really look in and say, what am I feeling? What is going on?
Right.
But that choice has been so empowering. Like, I feel stronger. I feel like I can handle more things. It's helped me grow a lot.
Yeah, they say meditation and therapy, I think, go hand in hand. I read a book about meditation, and I think once peace in every step or something like pieces every step. And he says, essentially, you figure out what you're feeling, and then you try to figure out why you're feeling that way. And he's like, that's essentially what therapy is.
So this is our very naive understanding, because we've only been practicing for a little bit, and we feel like we're smart. Now we're going to bring John into the conversation.
I never feel like I'm smart, for the record.
All right, fair. I feel like I'm smart.
Yeah, I believe that.
On to the mic. I'm very excited to have you on, John. Thank you so much for not only being on our show, but being so generous. We're actually recording this in the New York Insight Meditation Center, which is Thank you for your generosity.
No problem. It's our annex. We're in the annex.
Well, it's still
three floors below the center, and got this space.
I felt it when I walked into the center, and you can feel in the annex. You can feel like a piece. There's an energy here that's super peaceful.
Yeah, it's like there's something about any meditation space. It's like it starts to absorb what happens. Well, so the space itself becomes
the space, and that's what it is. There's an intention. Yeah. There's an intention of self-care or meditation or whatever, you know. And you're right. The space, you can feel it, and that's really powerful. And especially in New York, where everything is hustle. There's so much stimulus. Everything, to have a space where you can come in and you can feel that, it's very powerful.
It's really supportive, and the practice itself, as you were just describing, you must have had a really good teacher, but as you were just describing, the practice itself creates the space as well, so that you can be in the middle of New York, you can be in the middle of the hustle and bustle, and still have that spaciousness available to you at any time. And, you know, that's why we practice. So, yes, it's great to have a supportive space to come to practice, but at the same time, it's not just about the practice sitting on a cushion or on a chair. It's about what we do in the rest of our lives and having that spaciousness in the rest of our lives.
Well, before we dive too much into it, I would like to just read a formal introduction about you.
Oh, okay.
Because I think people want to know who you are, John.
Okay.
John is a certified teacher of mindfulness-based stress reduction at the New York Insight Meditation Center for the past 14 years, and he also co-founded the New York Mindfulness Meditation Collaborative, which I'm really excited to find out what that is. But the first question that I'd wanted to start in the entire thing is, what is meditation?
Yeah, that's a good question, because people confuse meditation and mindfulness.
Right.
Right. They think mindfulness is meditation. Mindfulness is a quality of mind. It's an attitude of mind. It's a way of being, which is cultivated by various practices of meditation. Formal meditation can be seen, in a sense, as a form of renunciation. We sit down on a cushion, we close our eyes or direct our eye gaze toward the floor. We've sort of cut out certain sensory input. And in that process, we can find some level of concentration, some level of spaciousness of mind. And, you know, there are many different types of meditation. The types of meditation that are conducive to the development of mindfulness have to do with becoming very aware of the body. And that means the whole body. It also means the specific areas of the body, most particularly the breath, where the sensation of the breath itself is an object of awareness that helps us to concentrate the mind and focus the mind. And once the mind has achieved a certain level of focus, then we can turn toward the process of the mind, which is what you were sort of talking about in the intro. Meditation is really about the process of the mind. It's about observing the process of the mind, not getting caught in the story of the mind, you know, which is more the why, but really the what and where and how, but not the why so much, because the why just takes us out of the moment, basically. You know, we start making up all sorts of things about the why, some of which are needed, and which is why we go to therapy. But with practices of meditation, we're actually able to see clearly, because we've really cut back on other input, we're able to see clearly what's going on at any given moment. What I love is, because there's been so much press about meditation and mindfulness in the last 10 years or so, but really it's actually accelerating. Whenever there's an article in the New York Times, the number of responses is mind-boggling, you know?
Wow.
And there was an article a few years ago that talked about why people meditate. And at some point, somebody wrote a response. It was a very Zen response. I just meditate to meditate. I don't want a reason to meditate. Because as soon as you put one reason out there, if you actually don't accomplish that, you think you've failed.
Right.
And yes, things happen. It can be great for insomnia. It certainly has an impact on stress reduction. And as you were talking about it, you know, we start to learn the difference between reactivity and response. We start to actually see how we live from reaction to reaction.
Right.
We start to see how we multitask so often, and as a result, we're exhausted.
Right.
So there are all sorts of things that result from the practices of meditation.
I've been really fascinated lately with the idea of process-oriented thought versus result-oriented thought, and that the results, allowing results to be byproducts of a process rather than what you're going for.
Yeah.
Is that relevant to meditation?
Yes. I mean, that makes perfect sense. It's, as I said before, it's about process.
Right.
Right. And this isn't to say you shouldn't have an aspiration, that it's not appropriate to have a goal. It's just how you hold that goal. And, you know, if you're holding the goal or the aspiration so tightly that you're missing everything along the way, and then you don't get the aspiration or the goal, then you will feel like you've failed.
And that's a huge message, especially for, I mean, it's a message for the entire world, but I think within the South Asian community, there's such a feeling around failure.
Yeah.
There's such a, you know, I actually, one of the questions I have is talking about the concept of meditating right. Because I still, like, in my practice, even though I know intellectually that there is not a right, I don't fully know. Is there a right way to meditate?
I never like to say right or wrong. I always get down on people who say I have a good meditation or a bad meditation, and maybe that's just the way I teach.
Right.
If you are aware of what's happening in the mind at any given moment, and you're clear on what's happening in the mind, that's a good meditation. So if you sit for 30 minutes or 20 minutes and you're spaced out the whole time, then you're not really meditating, you're just spaced out. The moment, however, that you know that you're spaced out, that's a moment where you're practicing,
right,
where there's an awareness of what's going on. Meditating is a very conscious activity. Knowing that fine line between spacing out and being spacious. It's a very moment-to-moment awareness of how the mind is. And so people think, because the mind is agitated, they think that they're failing. You know, they think that the idea of meditation is to stop thinking.
Right.
It's to stop thought. And you can't stop thought, because it's what the mind does. You can't empty the mind, because the mind just produces thoughts. We can hold that in a very different way, however.
There's two things that you said that I've always stuck in my mind from the class. I mean, there's multiple, but the two things that were like the wah moments. The first one was, you don't believe everything you hear. Or you said, don't believe
everything you think.
I
don't even know who made up that phrase. It may have been Sylvia Boorstein. She's sort of made it famous, but it's a great line.
But it's the first thing that you were the first time I had heard that. And as someone who had given so much power to certain stories and thoughts, I was seeing this pattern. It was a really liberating thing to hear. Don't believe everything you think. It's like, oh, wow. You know, in Hinduism, we're taught, like, everything's about the thought. And I'm like, I think there became an understanding that there's two types of thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know that there are those streams of thoughts. Then there's the awareness of those streams of thoughts. Now, the awareness itself isn't necessarily a thought. You see that those thoughts are just fragments, that those thoughts are repeating themselves, that those thoughts, as I like to talk about, have committees. So there's the finance committee, the relationship committee, the job committee, you know. And at that moment, you know, you sort of recognize, I didn't ask for this meeting of this committee. It's just happening. Those can be identified and seen for what they are. And as you were saying, you don't have to believe them at that moment. It's a knowing of, oh, it's just that thought again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we get too esoteric and, like, dive
yes.
into, I'm so excited about this stuff. That I might get too deep into, like, very specific things.
Yeah.
Let's go bring it back just a little bit to...
I actually never finished answering your question about what meditation is, I realize.
Okay, yeah, would you like to?
Yeah.
Is there more to that thought?
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, okay, great.
I see why you two got along so
yeah.
well.
So, and we haven't seen each other in years.
I know.
So, the types of meditation. So I mentioned the body-based practices, awareness of breath and awareness of the body, body scan. And then there are sort of much more open awareness practices. And then there are the various compassion practices, which are equally as important. Now, so, you know, they're usually taught separately, but they actually become quite integrated so that one's awareness is infused with compassion, self-compassion, and kindness, so that you're turning toward your experience from a place of kindness, whatever the experience is. We don't have to stop meditating just because we get off the cushion.
Right. someone to describe it, and I'm not sure if this was you or someone else I'd heard this from, but your formal practice is the drills, the sock, the kicking the ball in drills. Mm-hmm. Like you're doing your, or if you're a basketball player, let's go with that because I know
training
those drills better.
Mind.
Just like you're shooting the free throw thousands of times so that when you're in the high pressure situation where it's game seven and this free throw, all of a sudden the stakes are incredibly high, you have a practice, you have like a muscle memory.
Yeah,
there's like,
because
it does actually, science has proven like it does actually change the chemistry of
absolutely.
Your brain.
Well, it changes all the synapses.
Yeah, wow.
And so that it's changing connections. Yeah, it's exercising the mind, exercising the brain.
What is insight meditation?
Insight, which is the translation of the word vipassana, which can also be translated as clear seeing, seeing clearly the nature of life, seeing clearly the nature of impermanence, seeing clearly the nature of suffering, and seeing clearly the nature of non-self, basically. Insight arises through mindfulness. You know, if one looks at the stages of practice, you know, so one settles the mind, one concentrates the mind, and once the mind has achieved a certain level of tranquility and concentration, we start turning toward our experience. And as we turn toward that experience, and we start to see the reactivity and things like that, but when we really start to see, turn toward the experience, we start to see that it's constantly changing.
Yeah.
Right. And it's that constant change. On one level, if we hold on to something, then we suffer because of that change. But at the moment we realize that, oh, it's always changing, we have the insight that, if I just accept that change, recognize that whatever I'm dealing with, whether it's good or bad, is going to shift and change,
right,
then I'm not going to suffer as much. And of course, one of the big things that we sort of hold on to is our sense of, not our sense of self, but our identity. You're an actor, right? And you can identify with the various roles that you play.
Right.
But when it comes to just living our lives, you know, when we have those roles, we sort of forget that those roles are constantly changing as well.
Right.
Those are the insights that are arising. So it's not insights into, I need an insight onto whether I should take this job or not.
Right.
You know, although that may happen. You know, something may arise
in
practice that just, you know, clarifies that. But it's really much deeper, that the insights that we're talking about. It's
what are some of the positive impacts that meditation has had on you?
So something always brings us through the door.
Yeah.
And I would say relationship issues at the time, you know, although I'd been studying meditation much earlier in my life, it wasn't until the mid-90s when I was starting to see patterns in relationships. And I thought, there's got to be something that I'm missing in the way I'm living my life. So it took a while, and it took finding the right teacher. I actually realized that what was happening is that I was getting in my own way, so that the way I was identifying myself with my life was actually obstructing the progress of my life.
You found that out through meditation.
Yeah. And as soon as I sort of let go of that, and just let life live itself, let life live through me, or through this body, I should say, then everything became much lighter.
Was there like an aha moment, like it came to you in a meditation, or do you think it's something you slowly learned and you credited?
In my case, it was sort of gradual, because I would see when I would sort of find myself back in the old pattern, let that go and come back and just let things unfold, not get caught in how I was identifying with that. So it's interesting because I've never, trying to verbalize the experience is always challenging. But at some point I just saw that, wow, it's interesting how my life is unfolding now and I'm not trying to control the situation.
Hmm.
You know, sort of you let go of control in a sense and recognize that life is happening, but I don't have to try to control it in that sense.
One of my favorite quotes, there's several that I love. The quality of your life is in direct proportion to the amount of uncertainty you can comfortably hold.
That's lovely, yeah. Who's that from?
I don't know. Actually,
It's a good quote.
But I love that, and I will say that meditation has been a big part of me being able to hold my uncertainty.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the reason that I came was I was in between seasons of Nurse Jackie and I was uncertain. Like, I just like didn't know what to do.
Right.
And I didn't know whether it was coming back. And like, I didn't know when my next job was. And then the pattern I realized was that I started finding, I would latch onto relationships to solve that anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it became
That's a real pattern.
Yeah. Right. And so.
Yeah. But actually, there's a famous book by Pema Chodron, which is, I think it's called Being Comfortable with Uncertainty, basically. And not only was it being comfortable with uncertainty, it was actually loving uncertainty. It was like, wow. I don't know what's going to happen, you know, but am I willing to sort of take that step? I remember my teacher, my primary teacher, whose name is Matthew Flickstein, he always used that image from, I think, one of the first Indiana Jones movies, where Indiana Jones is like running out of down a tunnel, he's being chased, right? And then it gets to a cliff and there's nothing below him, and he just steps and a bridge comes up, basically.
Yeah.
I forget what movie that was from, but it's like that, you know, you sort of step into that void and something comes to support you.
Right.
A colleague of mine who I was doing a retreat with read the introduction to Alan Arkin's autobiography.
Oh, wow.
Which is a beautiful book. He used the title that I was thinking of using for my book, or it's kind of a variation on that.
He stole it. We're calling you out.
His book is called, I think, My Improvised Life.
Oh, cool.
But he's having a conversation with the actress Madeleine Kahn. This was obviously a number of years ago. And he's just pushing Madeleine Kahn, who has evidently a multifaceted, many, many talents. She was a great pianist. She was a great singer. She was a stand-up comedian. And she was a really good actress. And it's like, how did she decide what she was going to do? And she'd never really thought about it before. And then he writes, and then there was this silence. And she says, well, I always liked listening to music. And then he was waiting for, you know, the follow-up. And she says, I guess I just wanted to be the music. And that to him was like a striking sentence. And as I heard it, you know, told by him, it was like, yeah, letting life, the music, you know, be you, basically.
Interestingly enough, I am way more comfortable with uncertainty than certainty. Like, planning gives me a very weird anxiety.
Yeah.
It makes me feel constrained in a way I'm not.
Yeah.
Comfortable with.
Yeah. When did you discover that?
You know what? I think therapy, I've been doing meditation, but I was, my girlfriend, she had a job. She's a consultant. So she travels. We were in Parsippany and there was a bus to go back to New York. Cause I was like, I'll take the drive with you cause I'm an amazing boyfriend. And then I'll just find my way back to New York. There's a bus. I call the bus company. The lady says, okay, there'll be a bus outside of this gas station at this time. I'm like, all right, great. And then my girlfriend is like, well, see if there's another one after that. And then I asked that question, and then she was, all pertinent questions she's telling me to ask. Well, see if this one, is there another one closer to, and as she's asking me questions, I'm getting so like, stop it. I don't want to do, I will get there and the bus will be there or it won't. And I will find my way to New York. If it's not there, it's going to happen somehow. But then I realized all that planning was giving me anxiety, whereas most people need to know that. That made me feel confined.
Yeah. Although it's also interesting because when I like to have things, you know, unfold a certain way when it comes to like travel.
Right.
You know? I like to have time. I don't want to be pressured, you know, whereas my partner, you know, she lives on a different time zone, a different clock, you know, and it's like, you know, so when you're dealing in relationship, it's a great place to practice, of course, because you see what you're holding on to, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, you see how you're perfectly fine with that uncertainty and your partner's not. And that creates another, you know, thing that we hold on to because we want our partner to be exactly like we are, or we want, you know, we expect something,
right?
You know, where can we be, can we be okay with that too, you know?
Yeah.
And, relationship is just one of the best places ever to practice.
You know, so this brings me to my second thing that actually I got that took me a long time to understand. And at first, for like a few days, I was actually a little upset.
Good.
So I think I had this expectation that I'd created during that meditation class that it was going to save the relationship that I was in.
Ah, I vaguely remember this. Okay.
And then the relationship, we broke up. And I remember very soon after I finished the class, I emailed you and you wrote back. And literally all you wrote back was, what an opportunity to practice. And I was like, what the? This is it? This is what I get? And now that I understand that, it really, like, that sentiment, well, one, there was a sentiment of appreciation and gratitude of like, ooh, the openness to like, what can we learn? Like, what is in the experience, which I now can understand from that sentiment. But then true, like, everything is a practice.
For sure.
And it took me a long time.
Of course.
To be able to really understand that was a liberating and actually really beautiful way of living.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at this, oh, wow, like what an opportunity to practice. I don't know. It was really, I think about it a lot. I think about that sentiment.
And, you know, we with relationships in particular, I mean, especially romantically based relationships or love, we tend to get attached very quickly to the idea of the relationship.
Yeah. Right?
And the moment we're attached, we've set ourselves up for some form of suffering. You know, naturally, there's an initial phase to that, you know, because two people come together and they're attracted to each other, and then there's sex. Sex screws everything up, of course, but, you know, there's that. And then, you know, and then there's expectation. And then, you know, the moment there's expectation, something gets in the way, right? And that's, I talk about expectations in class and around relationship. People say, well, shouldn't I expect my partner to show up, and, or my husband or spouse to pick up my kid or whatever? And of course, you know, there's responsibility. That's another matter. But if your happiness is dependent on another person and you're attached to that person, you know, that's going to be a very short-lived happiness.
Which is what heightened a lot of my relationships.
Of course, me too.
I was dependent on that for affirmation.
Yeah.
And that was my thing, was my self-worth. I was trying to solve my self-worth through these relationships. I wasn't seeing clearly at
that
time.
Yeah, especially at the beginning of a relationship, you never see clearly. That's kind of the fun part of it, you know. And then, you know, you start seeing clearly, or at least seeing what's really happening, and you're, okay, now how do I work with that? Yeah.
I wanted to ask a couple questions that we had pre-prepared. One, is meditation for spiritual growth or stress reduction?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
No, I would say that...
What an opportunity to practice that, that answer.
It's a very
was.
Zen answer. So people will come into a class because they want stress reduction, but they will find that there's actually much more to it than that.
Right.
People will come for spiritual growth and they'll realize that their stress has been reduced. So there are several levels, and whatever brings people in the door for me is important. The words that are used is like, is it a pain reliever or a vitamin? Mm-hmm. You know, so is it short-term pain relief from stress, or is it long-term personal growth? And most people, and of course it depends on the teacher.
Right.
And where the teacher is coming from and what the teacher's own personal practice is and their own spiritual path. Because a lot of people teach meditation for stress reduction who are coming at it from a purely sort of psychological place. And they can be very good teachers to a point. And then there are those of us who have actually come to teaching through our own practice and our own spiritual growth. And so whether they're coming for a secular mindfulness-based stress reduction class, or as you did, you know, come for an insight meditation class, anything is possible.
Okay, I got it. And then another one I wanted to ask you, we had written down, is how do you keep it from becoming too commercial? And kind of on that note, my own thing I just thought of is you brought up meditation for a specific purpose is kind of, I don't know, you didn't seem particularly thrilled about it, whereas I told you I have Headspace.
Yeah.
After the initial 30 meditations, you start to meditate for a specific thing, for stress reduction, for confidence, for communication, whatever.
Really, that's the program?
Yeah, well, they have just a bunch of different packages
okay.
after that. Like there's a 30 meditation pack on stress reduction. And to be honest, the techniques seem like it's one of two or three things, like a visualization thing or breathing, but it's but they do package it that way.
Yeah. Well, there's marketing.
Right.
That's a very long conversation, and I don't think it's bad because at least it's bringing something good to people.
Right.
I think the issue, and the gentleman that started Headspace, I mean, he's a serious practitioner, but he's also, you know, a smart marketer, clearly, you know, and he's doing very well. There are a lot of people now that are sort of thinking they can teach these practices because they're popular, but they themselves don't have a very strong practice themselves.
Yeah, you're certified. Can you tell
us? So, yeah, I was certified to teach mindfulness-based stress reduction, or rather I was certified as a mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher. Mindfulness-based stress reduction is a very specific curriculum.
Okay, gotcha.
Designed originally by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who really is, I would say, the father of secular mindfulness, although he's a very deep, deep Buddhist practitioner. But he was a biophysicist, he was a professor at UMass Medical Center, and he developed this 8-week curriculum, which is kind of the standard. The 8-week curriculum has been around really since the early 80s, and it's the most well-researched curriculum.
Oh, wow.
There are plenty of people who are not certified who are teaching that particular curriculum, and they're perfectly good teachers. The certification is just kind of further affirmation that, yes, you know, you've actually done a lot of work here and you're, you know, that qualifies you for certain things. And now I'm actually teaching, doing a training program to teach people to teach it myself. So, you know, that's part of the process. And now, you know, suddenly there are all sorts of programs where you can train to teach, you know, but I would say that this particular curriculum, and I'm certified in another curriculum, which is very specifically around chronic pain. So again, you know, people will come and take these practices on because they want to deal with chronic pain. So if somebody comes in because they're in chronic pain and they've heard that this can help without drugs, and then they realize actually what's happened, that it can help, they can have real awakening moments, spiritual awakening moments, as they see through the pain. If it's pain that brings you in the door, if it's emotional stress that brings you in the door, if it's financial stress that brings you in the door, great, those problems may get addressed and more will happen. So it's really being open to what can happen. So if you go to Headspace and you click on the button for confidence, I suspect what's happening in that place is that it's looking at, well, what's getting in the way of your, what's the obstacle to your confidence, mm-hmm. right? So it's seeing through the obstacle, it's the right. practice.
Right.
I don't know if this is as true anymore because there has been so much being written about meditation and mindfulness and people are talking about it so much. But I wonder, I was quite intimidated by the idea of practice, the requirement of the discipline. I mean, again, for me, one of the was, I remember very young at our near our temple, they'd come and they'd done a meditation. They did a 45-minute sit for your first sit.
Whoa.
And I was not that old. Yeah. And I was just sitting there, I was like, I tried to like sit perfectly
right.
I like, and it kind of,
that would turn you off
a little. It was a little bit scarring. So to our listeners who might be intimidated by the idea of a practice,
sure.
but interested, what would you say to them?
Yeah. I mean, go easy. You build up as we were talking about earlier, you're building a muscle and it is like learning anything. You know, new, whether it's an instrument or a language or tennis, you know, it takes a while. And to be honest, I mean, the first practice we do in a mindfulness-based stress reduction class is about 40 minutes as a body scan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and for some people, it's really challenging. On the other hand, the first practice we do in a mindfulness for pain class is 12 minutes.
Right.
You know, the first practice we probably did in the Insight 101 class that you took was probably 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
Headspace is, what, 5 minutes?
10, I think.
10. When I do work in corporations, you know, they're 10 or 12-minute practices. So it's not the duration. It's really the discipline and the consistency. The reason the body scan is 40, 45 minutes is because it also, you know, works with other aspects of one's life, like patience or like curiosity. And you know, there may not be a sensation in your big toe, but if you just sort of sit there for a bit, you know, and wait and see what happens, you know, what's that like?
Oh, yes.
And it's an experiment. You're putting yourself in your own laboratory, you know, and you're sitting for 12 minutes, you're sitting for 15 minutes, you're sitting for 30 minutes, and you're seeing what happens without an expectation of what should happen. And if you practice with letting go of the expectation and are just able to even sit with your boredom for 30 minutes, what a luxury. Gosh, I can just sit here and be bored for 30 minutes.
That's
or I can
so
just
hard
sit
for me.
Here and be, it's so hard, yeah.
Last night, I literally was so like
wired.
Crawling out of my skin as I was, I meditate at night, which
yeah.
I know they say morning, but it's, for me, it's just easier to do at night.
Yeah.
But like I started, like my body like started convulsing a little bit. This
right.
happens sometimes because it's so hard to stand still
yeah.
and remind well, myself it'll pass.
Okay,
whatever, but, like,
but so that's a really interesting place to look at because as soon as you say to yourself, I have to be still,
ooh.
It's really hard to be still.
Right.
Right? It's like, be still.
Yeah.
Relax.
Yeah.
No, it's
yeah.
like you can't. Yeah. But if you just allow, nobody's there watching. Nobody's there with a gun to your head. Nobody, you know, stillness is great. But once you've planted the idea that you have to be still, you've created an obstacle to stillness.
Huh.
Wow.
And just sort of seeing that, it's like, oh, yeah, okay. I'll just practice and see what happens. And maybe stillness will happen, maybe it won't. But if there's no gun to your head saying, be still, I need to be still, I have to be still. If I'm not still, I'm not meditating. You know, that changes things, right?
Right.
I'm trying to remember, there's a famous teaching which basically says, if you're efforting to still the mind, the very effort is creating, is getting in the way of the stillness, basically.
Okay.
And once you see that, something shifts.
This is what I love. I mean, the compassion.
It's like talking to Yoda.
I mean, the compassionate energy that comes through, it's about allowance. So much of
it's about allowing.
It's so much of what I'm hearing through this whole talk and everything I've heard in class and everything is about creating space for allowance. I mean, even the way that you talked about your life and even the way she was saying about be the music, it's about allowing something through you.
Right.
And we talk about this in acting a lot. Like, we are our own instrument. So
exactly.
Creating the conduit so that you can open. And it's really thrilling to hear.
I'm curious, like, after you took the class and were, you know, sort of brought this practice more into your life, how did it shift your sort of process around auditions?
Around auditions?
Yeah.
Well, this is where, like, the opportunity to practice came up. One, I would use it a lot right before I was going in the audition, especially if it was a big audition that I would feel the pressure. I'd be like, okay, I'm aware this is a feeling. And I would just say, this is a feeling, and I would just, like, come to my breath. And that was really helpful to let go of the pressure. Because I know that I would definitely have messed up a number of auditions by being so full of pressure that I tighten up. And all of a sudden, that conduit, that openness of my instrument, it's not as flexible. I'm not ready to play. I don't have my energy's different.
Right.
But then also this joy, the opportunity, the gratitude that's been kind of cultivated almost organically through practice came up, and it's like, man, this is what an opportunity to practice.
Yeah.
It became like one opportunity.
Yeah.
And when I teach, I talk about auditions a lot. And the thing that trips people up is the pressure of, like, I have to do well. If I don't get this job, what's going to happen? Like, all of that stuff that gets in your way of just doing what you love.
Right. And it's going back to what you were saying about that comfort with uncertainty. It's like, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm just going to audition and do what I do.
Exactly. It's not, it's about the process. Yeah. It's about this moment rather than what this moment will yield.
Yeah.
And staying in that space of openness. We have a couple questions before we want to get into our stupid questions segment.
Oh, these are
stupid
questions. These are not your stupid questions. These are
the smartest questions you've ever heard.
These are the smart questions. Just wanted to clarify.
Okay. Oh, you know.
What are some misconceptions about meditations that might be a pet peeve or something that you would love the opportunity to debunk? Like, for me, a misconception that you've already debunked is the idea that you have to be still. Like, that's like the purpose is stillness.
Yeah.
So what can you...
Yeah, well, the other one that is often brought up is, like, I want to stop my thoughts. Meditation is about stopping your thoughts.
Right.
It's not. There's another one which is... meditation is about moving slowly.
Oh.
You know, and let's just say that there'll be more spaciousness, so it will feel like things are moving slower, but you don't have to move any slower, you know. Is it possible to rush through New York and yet have a still mind? And you know, you were sort of talking about that as you were dealing with your bus situation from Parsippany, you know. It's not about slowing down. I mean, although there are practices that we do which are definitely slow as a formal practice, but it's not about that. Yes, now that you've asked me the question, nothing's coming up, so there you go.
Well, that's great. The hardest part of meditation seems to be the consistency.
Right.
Do you have any tips?
Right. So Joseph Goldstein is one of the major teachers in North America. I mean, he really was responsible for bringing insight practice to North America, along with Jack Kornfield. He says, at the very least, look at your cushion or touch your cushion.
Right.
Or your meditation place to acknowledge that it's part of your life. So every day, that can be the practice. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I think it's really helpful in your home, even if you live in a studio apartment, to have a specific place, which is the place you meditate. My partner and I were, when we first moved in together, we weren't sure we wanted to live together, so we had a very large apartment in New York, you know, and we were bringing two incomes together, so it was okay. And we had a room that was our meditation space. And the room was meditating at 7:30 every morning, whether we were in it or not, you know. And we have the same thing in the place we bought. There's a consistency there. So again, it's an acknowledgement. And the other thing is you know, at least, and maybe we'll do this at the end of our time together, is, you know, a 3-minute breathing space. You can do that once or twice a day. That counts. So it's just, you know, taking the time to stop, notice what's happening at any given moment, how the mind is, how the body is, coming to the breath and just settle and then go on with your day. So that there are little formal practices that you can do, and Headspace is great for this, is just to stop a few times a day and really check in.
We ask this question of everybody, and this is usually, but I'm going to say, the question is, what is something that someone can do today? But will you be willing to lead some sort of 3-minute?
Yeah.
We'll put it at the end, because it doesn't feel really appropriate to do a 3-minute meditation and then go into studio the questions.
Yeah, good point. Okay.
Audience, we know we're going to get to that in a few minutes. But now is the time for stupid questions.
Guys, stupid questions is, I was so caught up in the questions I didn't even realize. Stupid questions is where we ask questions that people would want to ask but might be afraid because they think they're stupid. We have no problem being stupid. And in addition to those questions, we're going to ask some questions that we know are stupid, but it's fun to be ignorant.
Okay.
Yes, ask Donald Trump.
Is it okay if I fall asleep during meditation?
Yes, you will fall asleep, especially at the beginning. You know, you'll fall asleep. It's like, it's what the mind is used to doing when you close your eyes and are not doing anything. So it's okay as long as when you, well, first off, have a good sleep. But second, the moment you're awake, recognize that you're awake. And that's a real, you know, it's a great feeling. Oh, I'm awake. But people always fall asleep. And it's probably the most asked question in any sort of sit. Any group that comes together is like, I'm always falling asleep. What do I do about it? There are ways of working with sleep, but it is a major hindrance. It's all right, and it's a place of practice, and just sort of, maybe that'll be my standard. Yeah, it's just a place of practice. That'll be my answer for all these stupid questions.
Do I have to close my eyes while meditating?
Oh, no. Many traditions, that's not a practice at all. I mean, certain Zen traditions, you practice with your eyes open and just sort of gazing down at the floor about 45 degrees in front. There are also seeing meditations that are really effective. I actually have one on my website, which I think is really interesting. So no, you don't have to close your eyes.
When do you learn to levitate?
When do you learn to levitate? You tell me. I've never had that experience, but I hear it's possible.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I think it takes a lot of decades and decades of practice.
Decades? Probably. I thought you meant like months.
Will meditation make me lose my edge?
Actually, I think it's the opposite.
Wow.
I think that you become more aware of what your edge is and learn how to work with it more effectively. Hmm. We talk about, I mean, in the teachings, it talks about passions become subdued. To a degree, that may happen. At the same time, as the passions lessen, I think that edge becomes much clearer. And you are able to sort of work with it in a more conscious way. But that's a really interesting question that I've never had that question asked. I don't think that's a stupid question. So you might put that in the other category.
We'll edit that. Yeah. We'll put it back in the other one. What if I keep thinking about sex while I meditate?
Yeah, which is not uncommon. I mean, especially on a long retreat, you know, if something prompts you to start thinking about that, it's been a common hindrance. There are 5 hindrances, right? One of them is sleepiness. The other is sense desires. So sex would fall under the sense desires. So the normal way of working with sense desire is at that moment asking the question, is this helpful right now? Another way of working it is replacing that thought with some other thought that is more wholesome at that moment. And then there's the opposite of that. Well, not the opposite, but and literally in the Buddha's teachings, it sort of would talk about, you know, imagining the person you're thinking about sex with as a corpse, you know, or something like that. You know, so it's like, you know,
Right.
That's a bit dark.
It is a little macabre. But, so replacing one thought with another thought, basically.
Last one we'll go with is, how long before meditation will make me happy?
It's a great question.
Yeah, these aren't stupid questions either. How long before it will make me happy? How about how long before I realize that external circumstances are not making me happy? You know, at that moment where you realize that it's not the external which is making you happy, in fact, it's the external which can make you unhappy because you're holding on to something and expecting something, and that it's an internal process that makes you happy. Recognizing that, again, the changing nature of experience, and that your happiness, if your happiness is tied to something that's going to change, then, you know, you're constantly going to be going from happy to unhappy.
Yeah.
So the moment you see that and recognize, well, actually, can I be happy with this uncertainty? Can I be content with things as they are in this moment? Then happiness is there, right? Contentment is there. So
again, a byproduct.
Yeah.
The happiness becomes a byproduct of the process of just staying more present and open with this moment.
And, you know, I really think it comes back to this idea of the joy of uncertainty.
Right.
And, you know, there are stages of practice, and joy is actually creates energy, and the energy creates concentration. And then, you know, and then from that, we come to a place of equanimity, which means being content with the way things are, regardless of how they are.
Right.
Because there's an embodied understanding that things are constantly in change. So how long that takes? For some people, it can be instant. You know, for most of us, it's not.
Right.
And it's not something you go looking for. It can be a very slow process, but there are moments of it. And when you start to recognize those moments, and then those moments add up, if we're talking about happiness in this context, what we're really talking about is awakening.
Right.
The common word is enlightenment, or the word, you know, in Sanskrit word is nirvana. And I always forget the teacher that said this, awakening is an accident. Meditation makes you more accident prone. So some people literally fall into an awakened place almost by accident anyway.
Wow.
You know, they don't, and for some people it freaks them out.
Right.
You know, and they don't want to know what happened, you know.
This isn't a stupid question, but this is just like, it goes back to this conception thing. If I could just bend your ear for one more second. The conception that enlightenment or awakening or nirvana is somehow like a superhuman state. That once you're enlightened, you're impervious to pain, you're impervious. There's this, maybe this is just me. Maybe it's not a common misconception, but I had that conception for some time. And it was actually, another big moment of liberation, one that has been able to let go. I don't really have a question in here, but I just wanted to bring up that misconception.
I mean, there are levels of awakening, and I think there certainly are people or have been people, you know, for whom it's not that they're not experiencing pain.
Right.
Physical pain, they don't react to it the way most of us do. So, you know, there are certainly stories of people who have certain superhuman, what one would consider to be superhuman qualities, I suppose, who would be considered awakened. There are also people who one would consider awakened who have some not so healthy human qualities. You know, there are many famous stories about those people.
Yeah.
And so they're not quite at that level yet. But it's something that is possible for everyone on you know, various levels, you know. And the more we start to see what's happening and recognize those moments when we are in a different place, let me rephrase that, when we are awake, then things start to shift. Because we've experienced it, we've embodied it for at least a moment. And it's like that taste which keeps you going.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Sure.
Do you mind now leading us?
Yeah, that would be fine. Be happy to.
Wait, can I use a restroom first?
Yeah. So John is going to drop in a 3-minute meditation, or 3 or 4, however long he chooses. It's a few short meditation. Akash and I are going to join it. And you guys at home, this is something you can do right now. This is, you have a few minutes, even right now, then just join in.
Let's do the wrap-up stuff before and then end with the meditation.
Okay, great. And so...
Guys, very quick way to Zen is rate the podcast 5 stars. That is the quickest way to Nirvan. Rate the podcast 5 stars. Review, say this is the quickest way to Nirvan. And let us know you did it.
And John, how can people find you and find out about your teachings, find out about the collaborative that we didn't even get the chance to talk to about, and the New York Insight Meditation Center?
Yeah, so my website is johnaron.net. Very easy. JohnAaron.net. And New York Insight is NYIMC, New York Insight Meditation Center.org. And the collaborative website, which is, the collaborative is a collaborative of, I think, 40 plus teachers in the New York tri-state area.
Oh, wow.
Of mindfulness meditation, mindfulness-based stress reduction teachers. So it's very specific to that curriculum. And that website is mindfulnessmeditationnyc.com. So johnaron.net, nymc.org, and mindfulnessmeditationnyc.
You rock that Instagram, John Aaron?
I'm not there yet.
Not there. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
This could be our last episode for the season. So I just want to thank everyone who's tuned in. We are trying to do something that we hope is of service to our community and to people. And we hope you enjoy it. So thank you for listening. That's what I wanted to say. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
And here we go.
God bless.
Okay, so wherever you are at this moment, if you're sitting, find a posture which is upright and alert, yet relaxed. Your feet are firmly on the floor and your back is perhaps away from the back of the chair, but doesn't need to be. So we want a firm back and a soft front. And you can do this standing as well, just finding a posture which is balanced and in alignment. And if you're comfortable just allowing the eyes to close or just have a soft gaze on the floor. And just start by noticing how the mind is right now. So a lot of words have been flowing around here during this podcast. Just let those words settle. Notice if anything has been said which might be agitating the mind or energizing the mind, and just being aware of that. You don't have to do anything about it, just know how the mind is right now. Noticing how the body is just now, if there's tension in the shoulders, in the jaw, around the eyes, forehead. Just giving yourself permission to soften. Softening the belly. Hear sounds in the background. Just being aware of sound. Being aware of all the points of contact, your feet, your hands, the sit bones, contact of clothing, contact of the air on your skin. Just knowing the body sitting here right now, sensations coming and going. Including the sensation of the breath. More than likely that breath will be felt at the tip of the nostrils or just the rising and falling of the abdomen. And just for a minute, resting the awareness on this sensation of the breathing body. Don't have to do anything with the breath. It's just being aware of the sensation. However that sensation is experienced in this moment. Imagine each breath as an act of kindness toward yourself. Each out-breath as an act of kindness toward others. So just taking this amount of time at any point during the day is really an act of kindness, both for yourself and for others. And we'll close the meditation with a bell, and you can just allow the awareness to go with the sound of the bell. And as the bell fades away, allowing the eyes to open, and then returning to whatever you were doing and enjoying the rest of your day.